Welcome to the Blood Cancer Experience, a podcast by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada. This podcast connects people affected by a blood cancer to resources that inform, support, educate, and empower. When it comes to cancer, it's hard to navigate the unknown, and there are no easy answers. We're here to bring you the information you need to help make sense of every step of the blood cancer experience. My name is Montana Skirka, and I will be your host for today's episode. As a survivor of childhood leukemia, I am passionate about guiding others on their health journey as an integrative wellness educator. I work with individuals of all ages, teaching yoga and meditation, health coaching, leading wellness workshops, and podcasting, writing, and speaking out about the importance of a holistic approach to physical and mental health challenges. Today on the show, I am talking to Amanda Saunders. Born and raised in Newfoundland and Labrador, 23-year-old Amanda spent 2020 not only in a global pandemic, but also fighting blood cancer. She was diagnosed with a very rare type of cancer that was a result of a life-saving heart transplant surgery that she underwent in 2019. Today, Amanda is cancer-free and ready to share her cancer journey. Thank you so much, Amanda, for taking the time to talk to me today. It's truly an honor.
Thank you so much, Montana, for the opportunity. I'm so excited to speak with you today.
Yes, me too. And let's get into it because your story is one of a kind.
Oh, it really, really is. Actually, all my doctors that I have met along my journeys always call me one in a million and the queen of complications and all things medically interesting. So yeah, like you said, my journey was very, very interesting. It's long and vast and complicated, but I honestly wouldn't have wanted it any other way. I have learned so much about myself and life in general, and I met so many fantastic people along my way that I would never have met otherwise.
Wow. Well, we're going to definitely dig into your ability to stay optimistic as well, but let's start with, so your life kind of changes at 21 years old, right? This sort of whole journey starts then. So maybe you could give us a little bit of an insight into how this all happened.
Sure. Yes. Like you said earlier, I underwent a life-saving heart transplant in 2019. I was diagnosed with an extremely rare form of muscular dystrophy. And of course, the heart is a muscle. So in July of 2018, I was diagnosed in end-stage heart failure. What caused the heart failure was that I had a condition called dilated cardiomyopathy, which basically is a big fancy term for saying I had an enlarged heart. So I was put on some medications and some cardiac devices that had to work as my heart, basically, because my heart was just kaput, done. So I was sent into a hospital, which is 4.5 hours away from my hometown, just because I was just so unstable and just needed medical attention right away. So maybe about 3 days into that 16-day stay when I was in that hospital was that they were going to send me to Ottawa, Ontario for a transplant assessment because there was nothing else that they can do. They said a heart transplant was the only way for me to live. So that was a tough pill to swallow at 21 years old. And so I went off to Ottawa, and 8 days later, I ended up on the heart transplant list. I went into cardiac arrest during my transplant assessment and was immediately listed. I was at a stage 3.5 out of 4, which is at the near the top of the list. And 7 weeks later, I got the call for my brand new heart, and everything was great. The surgery was a huge, huge success, and I had some complications along the way, and actually 14 months after my heart transplant, I was given the scary diagnosis of blood cancer.
Wow.
Yes, wow is right.
And how did you feel during this whole process?
So actually, what ended up happening was I was sent back to my transplant center 4 or 5 times after my transplant because I underwent some very scary gastrointestinal infections. And being immunocompromised, it just sends that to a whole nother level. So like I said, I was sent to my transplant center, and things still weren't right after my gastrointestinal infections. I was dealing with severe abdominal pain that would never go away. I was losing weight left, right, and center, and I couldn't eat because of the intense stomach pains. I was sweating all of the time. I was a sweaty girl. I was a mess. And so I went in for some tests and procedures, and they diagnosed me with post-transplant lymphoproliferative disorder, or PTLD for short, saying that as a result of my heart transplant and a virus that became active while I had those gut infections, started growing cancer in my GI tract. And my transplant cardiologist was the one who diagnosed me. And I remember her sitting on my hospital bed saying, "We know what's wrong." And I just looked at her and said, "Can you elaborate? Like, what's going on?" And she said, "We found cancer in your GI tract and your colon." And I looked to the left at my mom, I looked to the right at my dad, then I looked at my transplant cardiologist. And I remember to this day what I said. And I said, "I'm scared." I said, I had a heart transplant 14 months before this. And that was a major life adventure in itself. And I said, "I don't know if I could do this again." I said, right? It was, I think the cancer was, is the cruelest complication of a transplant besides organ rejection. And I said, "I'm worried and I'm scared and I don't know what to do."
Of course. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that seems like a reasonable response to this. I mean, you must have felt at some point, like, when am I going to get a break? I mean, that's what I imagine I would feel if I kept getting this bad news after bad news.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head there. I was really at a loss because I said, how can this happen? This type of cancer only happens in 1-2% of organ transplant recipients. And I said, oh, of course I have to find myself in that percentage, you know? So I felt that someone was out there to get me. I felt so angry and hurt, and I was just at a loss. I, you know, had to withdraw from my school again a little bit. And I was away from my friends and my family. Luckily, my parents were with me. But I had to go through treatments by myself. I had to go through scans by myself because it was at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I was the youngest person in the room each and every time I went to treatment. And that is something I hope that no one will have to experience. It was the most isolated I've ever felt in my life.
That's another layer on top of this, right? Going through this whole experience during the pandemic. So really having to face this truly alone, I can't even imagine. But I think that bringing up anger is an important piece. I know that I felt a lot of anger. I don't even think I actually recognized how angry I was for so much of my life. And I think part of it is like, I was so angry, but there's no one to be angry at, you know what I mean? So it's complicated and confusing. And for me, I think I turned some of that anger on myself. I'm wondering, who did you feel angry at? Or was it just kind of a pervasive anger?
I was kind of angry at myself, to be honest with you, because I felt like I brought the cancer onto myself because, like I said, a virus became active into me. And as a result of those gastrointestinal infections I had, and I felt like saying, well, what if I didn't go get those GI infections? Would I have had cancer? Or if I did this differently, would have this happened? So I kind of went into the self-blaming game for a while. And I thought, like, this is 110% my fault. If I just did one small, minute thing differently, then this wouldn't have happened.
And that's way too big of a burden for anyone to put on themselves, right? To go through something like this and then to blame yourself or start to like think backwards of what I did wrong, what I did to deserve this, when so clearly it's nothing that you did, you know?
Yeah. And that was the same thing holds true when I had my heart transplant too, that like, did I do this to myself? Like, what is my body telling me to do? And I found the exact same thing again with my cancer treatment. Like, what is my body doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? Like, do I need to make some big lifestyle changes to avoid this or not? Right.
Right.
I was just so lost and confused. And
yeah. And I think we want to find an answer. We want to find something that's like, oh, okay, this is the reason that I have this. Right.
And
there's no answer. There's no answer to this. So going through these treatments alone, like, how did you get through it? How did you get through such a scary time in your life?
Connections actually what got me through. As you could probably already tell, I'm a major talker. So connections were really, really what got me through. I recognize this as a privilege, but I have the most supportive parents that anyone could ever have. Obviously, they weren't able to be with me for the treatment, but they were texting me and calling me throughout my whole entire treatment plan. And while I was gone away to treatment, I spent 8 days in a hospital by myself. And, you know, actually, my transplant center used to message me on the Ontario medical chart system to check in with me to see how I'm doing. And people offered to bring me food and snacks and blankets and water and everything like that. And those connections were got me through. And actually, while I was in treatment as well, the nurses and other medical staff, even the maintenance staff, I formed connections with, because there was nothing else that I thought I could do to make this situation better than speaking about it and just connecting with people. And like I said, the same thing held true with my transplant as well. I just spoke to anyone that would listen to me speak, and those connections were what got me through. And like I said, I have the most wonderful support system of parents and other family and friends and healthcare team. I would not be a fraction of the person I am today without them being on my side and advocating for my health as much as they have. I am beyond grateful for that.
Wow. I think that you point to something so important, which is that how important it, how much we need that support and how fundamental it is to our ability to get through something like this, right? It's everything, that connection.
Support is everything. And like I said, I recognize that that's a privilege, but I hope that it isn't a privilege.
And I would imagine that for your parents, this was also incredibly traumatic.
Right. So I am the only child. I think one of me is more than enough. Thank goodness for that. So my parents, I think, actually took the cancer diagnosis the hardest, because I'm their only child and there is cancer in the family. Obviously, my cancer is not genetically related to the other forms of cancer my family members have had and unfortunately passed away from. So they kind of thought that I would end up the same way of, you know, going, becoming extremely, extremely ill with it and that kind of thing. But they were actually stronger than I was, to be honest. They were there for me at every single step of the way, and anything that they could do for me, they would do it in a heartbeat. And I am immensely grateful for them. But I could just tell that it was hard for me. Like I said, when I looked to the left at my mom and to the right at my dad when I was diagnosed, they were white as a ghost and dead silent for days.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you feel like they were able to get support through that experience? Because I feel like that's really important too, is like, sometimes we can also, again, carry that burden of worrying about our parents if we see them so scared.
Right.
How were they able to support you?
They were everything that I have ever needed. They were there for me. And like I said, the doctors from my transplant center used to message me on the medical chart website that the hospital used. And actually, nurses and doctors and other professionals that I met along the way actually reached out to my parents to see if they needed rides to the hospital to see me. Obviously, they didn't know it was a pandemic. So, you know, they offered anything that my parents needed. And I have met some amazing transplant friends of mine along my route. And they have offered support to my parents as well, that anything that they need, no questions asked, they're there for them. I think that caregiver support is not often talked about. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be, because they carry the burden just as much as the patient does. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that the older I've gotten, the more I've been able to sort of think from their perspective. And I think it also makes me understand why it was so hard for me to express a lot of the sadness and anger that I was feeling during that experience, because right. I didn't want anyone to be more worried about me than they already were.
Right. You wanted to put on as much of a brave face as you could.
Right.
I know I did.
Yeah. And I think that that's rewarded, right? Like, there's something really inspiring about your brave face. And that's great. And we need a lot of bravery and strength and positivity to get through this. But it's also really important to be like, this is scary. I feel sad. Right. I feel angry, and have outlets for that, you know?
Right. You need to honor your emotions as they come. If you feel angry, allow yourself to be angry. If you're sad, allow yourself to be. If you're happy, goodness sakes, allow yourself to be, right? There is no perfect way to deal with the cancer diagnosis and treatment and life after cancer as well. It's just what feels right to you.
Absolutely. I mean, you have so much wisdom in your young age. And were, like, what were the outlets that you were able to express those emotions during this experience?
Again, with my support system, if I felt angry, I said, okay, everyone, today is an angry day. Let's not tell my diabetes team, and let's just go out for ice cream and go for a drive and, like, blast Taylor Swift on full volume. Like, let's
Amazing.
Go.
Yeah.
And I write, you know, okay. I've been journaling my whole transplant experience, my cancer experience as well. So that has been really, really helpful to me. And I'm a big reader as well. If I want to escape the cancer world for a little bit, I would just gravitate to whatever I was reading and kind of immerse myself into their world. But then also another thing that I kind of touched on was my education. I did withdraw from school a little bit, but I still want to, like, grab some sense of normalcy there for a little bit. And so I'm a psychology student at the Memorial University of Newfoundland's Grenfell campus. They are the best campus, not being biased here. But I was able to complete my major research project while undergoing cancer treatment. They were just as supportive. And so I wanted to, like I said, to attain some sense of normalcy there and really focus on my studies as much as I could.
Wow. So you were actually working while you were getting treatment for cancer?
Oh, yeah. I would go to the hospital for treatments that would last a few hours, and then I'd go home and write my major research. Like, it was nothing.
And you found that that was helpful for you?
Absolutely. It gave me kind of an outlet to not focus on the cancer at all and just dive deeper into my education and academia. And it was hard. I'm not going to lie to you. So, like, oh, it was a breeze, you know. But obviously, if I needed the time off for a little bit, I obviously did that. But I don't think my cancer experience wouldn't have been as successful as it was if I didn't have my education there to back me up.
Right. Because it provided you with this sense of normalcy. And like you said, this little bit of escape where you could go back and sort of not have to think about yourself as a patient. I can definitely relate to that as well. But I think it sounds like you got a lot of support, and the right type of support, where people were listening to what you wanted, because all of us are so different. And, you know, just saying, okay, we're here. I mean, I think not everyone, like you said, gets support, specifically from medical professionals. The fact that doctors and nurses were reaching out to your parents, asking them for lifts, I mean, that's incredible and so wise of them to recognize that, and how I'm sure beneficial it was for your parents even to just get that offer, to be like, oh, okay, they understand that I'm also part of this. And then the fact that, like you said, you were able to talk to your university about what you were going through and get that support. I think for a lot of people, maybe they don't even know that that's available. And so I think it sounds like you were able to articulate your needs.
Right. And that actually extends from my heart transplant. I felt like if I didn't go through my heart transplant first, my cancer experience would have been different. Like, I wouldn't have been so open about it and so vocal, like you said, to vocalize what I needed and that kind of thing. So yeah, as soon as I got my cancer diagnosis, I didn't tell anyone for like the first 3 days. I'm like, nope, this is not real. Goodbye, good night. But after I kind of realized, like, oh, okay, yeah, I have some cancer going on, so maybe I should do something about it, I emailed my university and said, look, I know I just had a heart transplant, but I have cancer now too. So how can we make this work? And I think that's really important. And I know that it's really, really anxiety inducing to do that. I know I wouldn't have been able to do it if I didn't have my heart transplant to ask for those needs. But those needs and services and resources are there. Mm-hmm. You just, unfortunately, they don't always come to you. You have to go and find them, which is really, really, really hard.
It's really hard. And it's a huge, again, burden to put on someone. Like, you're going through so much, and then you have to start figuring out what services are available. But I think you're right. I think that I was shocked when I found out the resources that were available at my university, for example. But there was another part for me, and I wonder if it was similar with you at all. Like, for me, I needed a lot of mental health support when I was in university. I felt very isolated going through experiences that my peers weren't. And I remember there was like mental health support, and it was at a certain part of the university. And I was so embarrassed to be seen going into that building that sometimes I just wouldn't go.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So my university also has mental health services. I actually made a bail-out actually before my heart transplant. But I deal with mental health, you know, issues myself. I've been diagnosed with trauma-induced anxiety. But actually, my mental health resources actually came from my transplant center. I said to them, look, I had a heart transplant and I had cancer within 14 months of each other. And I said, it's a lot right now. I feel like the world is out there to get me. And, you know, someone is trying, you know, out for me, you know, who is it? But, and they actually connected me with the right mental health services. The mental health services did not come from my cancer place at all. It was all solely the heart transplant community that got me to the services that I have.
Wow.
Yeah.
And again, that's just about advocating for yourself and being really intuitive about what you were going through and what you needed. Because oftentimes with these things, maybe the mental health piece isn't even brought up by our healthcare professionals.
No, and I pushed the mental health side of it so far into the ground, you couldn't even see it. I just said, let's just deal with the physical of it all first. And then once I'm physically healed, probably the mental health stuff will go away. That's not true in the slightest. So now I'm kind of reaping the mental health side of it and playing catch up with the mental health side of it now. And that has been a huge, huge challenge. But I'm grateful that I do have the resources. But like I said, those didn't come to me easy either. Again, I had to do the searching, and it sucks to have to do that. I think physical health is just as important as mental health, and I think that they should go together, especially with a cancer diagnosis. It's so life-altering. So hopefully positive change can be created, and along with physical services, mental health services will be right there alongside of it.
I completely agree with you. So many of my appointments with medical professionals, I felt like I had to almost plead my case and like get them convinced that I needed extra support.
Right.
And just the amount of times I would go to a medical professional and then not know what to do after with all the emotions that were brought up during those appointments.
Right.
And just go into the bathroom in the hospital and just cry my eyes out by myself. It's so hard.
Yeah. And that, I feel like that's also not talked about either, is the mental health side of it, especially survivor's guilt. I deal with it on both ends of the spectrum. Actually, I had a heart transplant and I had to wait for a deceased donor to be able to have a heart. And so obviously I grieve my donor and their family every single waking moment for the past 2 years. I keep thinking, you know, what did my donor leave behind? And same thing with a cancer experience. You know, a lot of people unfortunately may not survive through their cancer experience. And I know I have family members and friends of mine who didn't. And that was wreaking havoc in my mind for a long time as well. That will that also be me? And I did survive cancer, and I feel bad about that because, you know, people don't. It is a cruel, cruel disease. And I think that's the hardest part of life after cancer. From the emotional side of it, for me, is dealing with so much guilt. I actually felt not embarrassed, but guilty of saying I am a cancer patient and I am a cancer survivor because of that. My treatments that I went through are not grueling at all. I have no long-term side effects from treatment besides the fact now I have wavy hair instead of it being stick straight. That's the only thing that ever came from cancer treatments of mine. And I wasn't incredibly sick after them. I actually felt better the first treatment that I had. I walked out of the hospital and I said, like, oh my gosh, I won the lottery. Like, what is this medication that they gave me? Like, can I have more of it? Because I feel great. But I also thought on the flip side, wow, like, cancer treatments for most people are really, really hard. And I didn't have to experience any of that. And I'm grateful for that, of course. But on the flip side of it, I felt extremely guilty for that. And I still do to this day.
And I think that's so interesting because, I mean, I don't think any human hearing your story is thinking that that's an easy road. Like, what you went through is miraculous, is something that most people can't even fathom, right?
Right.
And so the fact, I don't even think it would cross people's minds that you would even feel any sort of guilt about being like, oh, I can't call myself a cancer patient because it was so easy for me. I mean, your story is not an easy story, right?
No, absolutely not. Would not recommend.
No, exactly. And I think that just shows how hard it is sometimes for us to like give ourselves compassion and just see ourselves the way that other people see us, right?
Right.
It's really hard to see our own strength and our own challenges clearly. But I hope one day that you're able to sort of see yourself as the way that I see you, which is incredibly strong, resilient, and definitely, you know, whatever label you want to put on yourself, like you deserve it,
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
So you talked about anxiety. You talked about trauma-induced anxiety anxiety caused by trauma, right? And trauma is such an interesting, misunderstood thing. And post-traumatic stress disorder or trauma-related depression, anxiety, what have you. And I think that we're living in a time now where, thank God, a lot of this stuff is being studied and understood a little bit better. But I know for me, like even the idea that I had trauma due to my health experiences was not understood by me. And honestly, I don't even think understood by medical professionals, including therapists. So it's like you're saying, like when you deal with post-trauma related issues, it doesn't necessarily just go away or fade away with time, right? It can live on and linger. And for me, it got worse and worse and worse as time went on. And I did not understand it. And I think it's because maybe PTSD related to health challenges is no one talks about it. Right? So it's so hard to understand and to be like, what is going on with me? Like, why am I not just feeling grateful and happy and with all the survivor's guilt? If I've just went through this really traumatizing thing, like I should be grabbing life by the horns and I should be happy and ecstatic all the time. And I just kept feeling worse and worse and worse as the years went on. So I think that's such an important topic for us to delve into and kind of help people understand from a first person experience, you know?
Right. Trauma is so, so real, especially from the health standpoint, which again, just like you, I didn't really recognize it until after I began to heal physically. Actually, fun fact, when I went for one of my cancer treatments, I'm like, oh yes, I'm here for my treatment. I have PTLD. And someone said, you're on the wrong floor. And I said, excuse me, like, what are you talking about? Like, I was here last week. Like, I know I'm in the right place. And they thought I said I was diagnosed with PTSD and that I should go on the mental health floor. I said, not quite. Like, no, I'm here on the right floor, but thank you for your concern. But like you said, I didn't really recognize that I had trauma-related issues until I started diving deeper into my emotions. And after my physical healing, I'm still recovering from my transplant and I'm still kind of recovering from, you know, being a cancer survivor now as well. And just like you, I feel like I should be on cloud nine that I am cancer free and I have a brand new heart and I should just live life to the fullest and not look back or think twice. But it's not that simple. And
no.
My transplant was very, very complicated. I actually was in a coma for 4 days after my transplant because something extremely rare happened. And I was actually had to be put on dialysis because my kidney stopped working because my heart stopped. So I was in ICU for 2 weeks and then 2 weeks again on the surgery recovery ward. So I was in the hospital for almost a month after my transplant.
Wow.
Yeah. And I was in the intensive care unit for 23 days after my transplant. And I've heard a bunch of, you know, codes and incidences where, you know, people were really, really sick. And I had some codes myself and that kind of thing. And those flashbacks come into my mind all the time. And I always think about the what ifs as well. Like, what if my cancer comes back? Mm-hmm. What will I do? What if I go back into heart failure and need a second heart transplant? You know, like, mm-hmm. what if my medication doses are off and who will notice? Right? And like I said, I'm in Newfoundland, Labrador, and my transplant hospital is 3,000 kilometers away. So what if I need attention and that kind of thing? So that's where my anxiety stems from, is more so the what ifs and what else can life throw at me, right? Because I had two life-altering diagnoses 14 months apart. And actually, I was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, also a result of my transplant. So now I have three altering diagnoses now in 2 years apart.
Wow. And you're 23.
Yes.
Like, you are 23 years old.
Yes. I will be 24 on Monday.
Ooh, really happy birthday.
Wow. Thank you.
And I know you have another exciting anniversary coming up.
I do. On this Saturday, March the 6th, will be my very first diagnosis anniversary of being diagnosed with blood cancer.
Wow. When you speak, it seems so obvious. It makes so much sense that you would feel anxiety, right? Like, if you didn't feel anxiety, that would be like, wait, what? You know?
Right?
It's totally makes complete sense. And yet, the resources and the understanding is not really available for people with health complications. And I think that that's, it just makes it life very difficult. And it makes people that go through these experiences feel very alone and very confused about their own minds. And I was diagnosed with a complicated form of ulcerative colitis when I was 17, went through a bunch of surgeries. And it was in my late 20s that someone said to me, like, you have trauma-related depression, trauma-related anxiety. And that's why going to therapy for sort of quote unquote normal or a different type of generalized anxiety wasn't really working for me. And so I started to delve into that world and started to go to programs and meet people that had different types of PTSD. And I remember it when I would listen to the stories, because I did a lot of group therapy in the trauma world. And when I would listen to people's stories about just horrific experiences that they had been through with sexual abuse or with just awful things, I felt very guilty and very like, oh, when I tell my story,
it seems so minor compared to someone else's.
It seems so minor, and I'm so embarrassed. And I said that to them. I'm like, I don't think that I deserve to be in this group.
Right.
Like, what you have gone through is so traumatic. And what I went through, I mean, I was 7. I got really good, great care at Sick Kids. Like, who am I to even be in this room?
Yes. Preach it to the choir. Because I felt the exact same way. And actually, that's why I don't go to groups. It's for that comparative reason, that if I hear someone else's story, I'm not saying that the story is invalid, of course, that's not what I'm saying. But if I could start to compare myself to someone else's trauma, that I would diminish my own. So that's why I have been seeing a psychologist privately, because I can't allow myself to diminish my own trauma in that kind of thing. Right?
Yes. And once I told my story to these individuals, they turned to me and they're like, you are in the right place. Like, what you went through is deserving, whatever that means,
right?
Of having a place in this community. And again, it just needs to be more broadly understood, I think, from the medical perspective, from the social perspective. Like, when you are declared cured of cancer,
you are not cured from the mental health side of it.
Exactly.
That's just the beginning, in my mind, of the whole emotional journey of cancer.
Right. And even to come to this understanding at such a young age is, I think it's really inspiring and incredible. And it gives you the rest of your life to work towards everything that you want to accomplish, because you've definitely been through the hardest part of it.
I agree. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to the future and I'm optimistic about it. But again, obviously due to what I've experienced, you know, from the health side of it, it is hard to overcome that, but I will in time. And like I said, I'm very excited for what the future and what it holds, because I know it's looking bright, especially obviously when the pandemic is no longer a major issue.
And I just, you know, I try to tell myself every day, like, how important patience is with myself and how important self-compassion is with myself. Right. When I think about how much of my life I was ill and I was in survival mode, right?
Yes.
So it takes time for us to learn and relearn and heal from these things.
Yes. Just like you said, I also went into survival mode with both my transplant and the cancer experience, that I was just focusing on what I could do in that moment. If I could eat today or could I not? Would I be able to go for a walk with my parents after treatment or will I not? It was just very much living from one minute to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. And so now you're able to, it sounds like you found really great resources to be able to work through that, which is so important.
And I'm immensely grateful for that. And I recognize that as a privilege as well. And I don't think it should be. I think it should be also made available to anybody that needs it.
I completely agree. I'm interested to talk about your experience with your peers, because you're at an age, I mean, and at any age, our relationships are so important, right? And our young adulthood and our like 20s is usually the time when we're kind of figuring out who we are and like finding different peer groups and learning about ourselves and experimenting. And oftentimes we don't think about these types of topics that we've been talking about as part of that experience. So how has it been like with you, for you as a university student or just as a young adult, interacting with peers? And has that been difficult at all?
It has been really, really hard. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, it was great, because it was not. I know nobody with PTLD at all. So trying to find someone to connect to and maybe relate to my experience was non-existent. Obviously, I had the most amazing friends and support system in that regards that understood what I was going through, but I've had it really hard to speak to them as well because they were also there when I had my heart transplant. So I did want to add more to the burden. So I kind of kept things as quiet as I could with my cancer experience because I didn't want them to stress and to worry about it. So being a young adult having cancer and having survived it, I think taught me a lot about myself. I did a lot of self-discovery because there was really no one else that I could kind of speak to and relate to amongst like some of my age. And so I actually attended a cancer writing workshop in May of last year. And the author or the person in charge of the workshop said that cancer is not a gift, but it is a lesson. And I feel that those are the truest words ever spoken. I have learned so much about myself in the sense that I have to be patient and I just can't be go, go, go all the time. I thought I had my life figured out at 23 years old, right? I thought after my heart transplant, like, woo, I'm off the hook. Nothing can ever happen to me. Like, I'm going to do great. I'm going to graduate and get a degree and move on to degree number 2 or 3 or 4 or whatever. I get to, you know, get my own house and get a new dog and a new car and that kind of thing. But I quickly learned that life can throw rocks in your path and really take things away from you. So finding a peer thing again was also really, really hard. And I still kind of struggle with that to this day. But I also realized that this was a perfect time to do some self-growth and to kind of figure out who Amanda Saunders is. Because I wanted to know who I was. I wanted to take the time and to learn who I was.
And honestly, most people are not doing that type of self-work at this age because they're still trying to achieve those goals like you were talking about before, right? And so I think sometimes, I know for me, like it's very isolating and scary to go through this. And even though I knew that, like there was part of me that sort of saw past the rat race, you know?
Yeah.
But there was another part of me that so badly just wanted to be part of it so I could be part of something.
Right. You know, half of my treatments were in Ontario and half of my treatments were in Newfoundland. So when I was in Ontario, there was nobody that I could really speak to immediately. I couldn't surround myself with my friends. They all moved on, graduated from university, started getting jobs and houses and cars, and they were achieving their goals, which is great. And I'm so immensely proud of my friends for being able to do that. But I also kind of felt left behind. I'm like, wait, guys, I'm still here. Like, hello, that I'm still in university. I am set to graduate in the spring, but you know, I felt kind of guilty that like I was left behind and like, I'm still in university. I'm still living with my parents. I'm almost 24 and I still live with my parents, right? And I'm grateful that they let me move back in with them, but I want to be on my own and I wanted to have some sense of normalcy so quickly after cancer, but it didn't come that easy because I had a lot of healing to do and emotionally. And I know I will get there in time. Like I said, I'm set to graduate in the spring and I applied to my second degree program. But the peer thing again was really, really hard while going through it.
Of course. I think that it's really hard for us to not compare ourselves to each other, right? And especially these days, like with social media and just all the ways that we can judge and compare ourselves to other people.
Yes.
Right? And it's like they haven't gone through even, I mean, your experience and theirs is so vastly different that it's just not fair to you to even think to compare yourself to them, right? And so it's all about finding what's going to give us joy and us happiness and us fulfillment.
Right.
Which is easier said than done in a world that sort of wants to feed us images that are not realistic, right?
Yeah. And social media was especially toxic for me while going through treatment. Like I used to scroll on social media and like, again, compare, you know, myself to others that like they're working or they have a new dog. Well, I have a dog now too, but that's besides the point. But, you know, I was just comparing myself and I'm like, wait, they're not facing blood cancer or they're not facing a heart transplant that I'm aware of.
Oh, and the other thing I want to talk to that's I think connected to this piece of comparison is the added thing for me, which was when I think about my whole journey, it was such a big piece of it for me was just embarrassment and self-consciousness about my appearance as a young woman.
Yes. I'm on steroids as a part of my heart transplant regimen of wavering off organ rejection. And I developed the dreaded moon face that every person that goes on steroids gets. I was on a very, very high dose of steroids for the longest time, and I'm still on steroids to this day. And I hated taking pictures of myself, and I hated going out and meeting friends or seeing my transplant friends or whomever, because I despised the way that I looked. When I was in heart failure, I lost a lot of weight. And after transplant with steroids, I gained it right back again, plus some, which was great. You know, I needed the healthy weight gain, but I was so, again, like you, so deeply embarrassed of what I looked like. Again, like I said earlier, I now have wavy hair instead of being stick straight. And I had to learn how to use mousse for the first time and try to make my wavy hair not look like angel hair pasta and look make it look somewhat decent, right? So I too face a lot of body image issues. I still kind of do to this day, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You know, your steroids will reduce in time and the complicated and grueling side effects of treatment will not be there forever. Some may, but some, you know, the really scary ones may not. And you, I think that you always have to look forward a little bit, but also monitor your emotions at the same time. I'm not saying to bypass them and bottle them up because it's only going to go kapoof and will backfire in the end of the day, to be quite honest. I think it's such a privilege to also be on medications that this way because they do waver organ rejection. And they are working, they're doing their job, which is immensely appreciated, but I understand. And actually, I do have a little bit of a prednisone growth on the side of my face. And they actually thought it was cancer, so I had to go for a face ultrasound.
Oh, no.
And the Goop, I'm telling you right now, it's not a good facial moisturizer. It is awful. It is not great. No, definitely not. So I had that like little bit of growth on my face as well. And it sticks out, especially when I laugh and smile. But I recognize that, okay, that just adds to my experience. And I also have a bunch of scars from my transplant. I have 6. And I flaunt them proudly because...
Good for you.
Because I recognize, like, heck yeah, I survived a heart transplant. Like, let it show the world how proud I am of them. And that took a lot of work. I just didn't come out of transplant flashing everything, you know? I was embarrassed. But after a while, especially this actually came very, very, you know, it grew along with my cancer experience as well because I had a PICC line in my arm for treatments. And I named him Kevin, by the way. And I was so embarrassed to show Kevin because I didn't want people to ask me why I had this weird line in my arm. But I realized, like, this PICC line is amazing. It is a great way for me to access my cancer treatments and take blood from because I hate getting blood work done. I would rather do anything else to get blood work done, to be honest. I would rather lick the floor. But anyway, so I was very proud in the end to show my PICC line that I am able to access treatment and I'm able to get blood drawn without getting stabbed. And that took a lot to do.
And I think you're highlighting why the mental health and emotional support is so important, because it's helping us rethink these things that, like you said, are life-saving. It's prednisone was my lifesaver and my biggest enemy.
Yes.
I had an ostomy for 6 months due to my colitis treatment and the colectomy that I got. And I had an ostomy for 6 months and I basically like hid in isolation because I was so embarrassed. And when I think back on it, I'm like you said, it was part of my treatment. It was life-saving, but I also can really sympathize with myself for how scared I was and how embarrassed I was for if people knew or what they would say or what they would think about me. And I think anytime I would go to an appointment, they wouldn't necessarily, again, like acknowledge that maybe it would be emotionally difficult for me to have an ostomy or emotionally difficult to lose your hair or to be on prednisone moon face or all that stuff. And it's like, yeah, of course it's hard, right? Being weighed every appointment and like be having my weight tracked on this like dehumanizing scale.
Yes. Oh, weigh-ins are the worst. When I was in heart failure waiting for my heart, I had to do weigh-ins every single day at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I used to dread waking up. I said, I don't want to look at my weight today. And it was dehumanizing. I understand that this is for treatment purposes and life purposes, but you also kind of have to realize at the same time that there is a mental aspect to it as well. And again, that's often very much ignored and it's very annoying and tiring that it's not. And I hope, especially with talking to you, and that this becomes more aware and more highlighted in society and in the medical world, that don't ignore mental health. Don't ignore emotional health, because the both are so tightly knit.
Yeah. And I think there's just a little bit more compassion and understanding and supports that clearly we need in our system. But I think we're getting there. And I think that you want to be part of that. So tell me about your future plans.
I do. Thank you for leading into that. So like I said, time and time again, I received oodles and oodles of amounts of support from the medical team that I never ever thought I would, and I'm immensely grateful that I actually kind of get emotional when I speak about it. So earlier on I mentioned that I applied to degree number 2, mm-hmm. and which is social work. So wow. I hope to one day work with, you know, people that have similar medical situations that I do and kind of be their soundboard. And when you know people that experience similar things to you, if you feel this bond with them right away that only you two will know and understand, right? So I want to be that person for people that are maybe undergoing a heart transplant in the future, or have a muscular dystrophy diagnosis, or type 1 diabetes, or blood cancer even. Anything that I can do to help a future patient with those things, I would do it in a heartbeat. And I'm so excited to hopefully pursue that career and really advocate for those people that, you know, it'd be similar to those people that advocated for me. It's kind of like a give back scenario. And I'm immensely grateful that I hopefully will get to do that in the near future.
Well, I wish you all the best with that. And I'm really excited to hear about your ongoing journey and hopefully glean some more wisdom and positivity from you in the future.
Thank you.
Yes. So thank you so much, Amanda, for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Montana. It's been such a joy talking to you as well.
If listeners have any questions about caregiving for someone with a blood cancer or need support navigating your experience, I encourage you to connect with the community services manager in your region. Visit bloodcancers.ca to connect with us. Thank you to TELUS Friendly Future Foundation for generously sponsoring today's episode. Until next time, stay well.
Thank you for listening to the Blood Cancer Experience podcast series by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada. You can find us wherever you access your favorite podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and leave us a review. If you have a great idea for the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email with your comments or suggestions at canadainfo@lls.org. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Canada is dedicated to funding cutting-edge research and supporting people affected by blood cancers. To learn more and access resources, including fact sheets, booklets, and webcasts, visit bloodcancers.ca.